This is Circe Olson-Westner, Executive Director of the Museum of the American Military Family in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and this is our podcast, Schooling with Uncle Sam. Today I'm speaking with my father, Alan Dale Olson. He's the Public Affairs Director for our museum. Hey, Dad.
Hello, Circe.
Hey, I was thinking that it might be nice today to talk about some of the other aspects of Dodds or Eustesia school history. I was wondering what it was like mixing educators and military service members. Their cultures must have at times been complicated. Can you think of a couple of incidences where personalities clashed?
Well, of course, there are personality clashes in just about any profession or any walk of life. And I'd like to characterize the relationship officially between the school system and the military by saying that from the very beginning, going all the way back to even before World War II ended, when plans were being made to bring dependents to Europe and to Japan, at the end of the war with the military sponsors, that there was universal agreement that the schools would be run by civilians, that the military would be responsible for support of the schools, logistic support and providing facilities, but that the actual academic programs would be totally civilian and meet full accreditation standards in the U.S. That said, of course, the military is a highly disciplined, well-regimented profession with high standards and rigid standards, whereas the education profession is made up of people who like to be curious and explore and try things and experiment, and who may not in every case respond particularly favorably to the rigors of military discipline. So yes, there have been some personality clashes, but so far none of them have been terribly serious, and none of them have led to any far-reaching negative impacts on either side.
So, in the early years of DoD schools, the higher level military officials, some of them must have been World War II combat veterans. Can you think of any stories where having been through World War II affected decisions made by military officials over the civilian teachers?
I don't know if I could be that specific or not, but I do know that especially in the early days where military commanders were prone to think that, let's say, a discipline problem can be handled on the spot immediately without retribution, whereas teachers and principals like to think that a child should be given another opportunity or that there should be time to reflect and think why a child misbehaved. And so occasionally there have been disagreements between a commander charged with supporting the school and a principal charged with supporting the children who attend the school. Not very many, but it happens once in a while, and both sides have had to give and take a little bit. We've had instances where commanders kind of resented the way young male teachers dressed with long hair or with beards, or some of the military wives resented the way some of the female teachers dressed fashionably, or I hate to use the word provocatively, but in a less conservative style than a military wife would be expected to dress. But for the most part, these things sorted themselves out.
So, were there ever any tensions in those early days with the German nationals and the military and the teachers? Or
I don't think so where the schools were concerned. Of course, in the immediate years after World War II, at least in Germany, there were anti-fraternization rules among the military to discourage military members from becoming overly friendly with Germans. In large part to make sure that nothing untoward happened as a result of war animosities. Those gradually wore down, but where the schools were concerned, there were solid initiatives to help the school kids, and the teachers too for that matter, get more involved in things German, and to learn more about the host country, and to learn more about the culture of the Germans. This does not mean we glossed over the problems and of the war and the atrocities in Germany before the war, but it does mean that both sides, and somewhat different, when I say both sides, I mean the military side and the and the education side, in somewhat different ways, strive for the same thing: better understanding of the two cultures, better understanding of the people, the Germans who hosted the American visitors, and in the early years, occupiers, and later years, partners. But they were working toward the same ends. And for the most part, that worked out quite well, too. In fact, the American military hired a great many German citizens. And there have been cases where, I know of one personally, where one of the German drivers hired to work for a colonel had actually been in combat against that colonel in North Africa during the war. And another German driver I knew had been part of Hitler's youth group. So those things are bound to happen and did happen, but overall they kind of took care of themselves.
Now, we mentioned Germans, but this was played out in any of our host nation countries at the time, right after World War II. So Japan and Italy and France and things like that.
You have to realize, though, that in each of these nations there were nuances of difference. In the case of Germany and Japan, for example, they were defeated nations. We actually conquered them in war, and we occupied them with or without their consent. We wanted to make sure that the war was really over and that the alliance headed by America would keep them from rising up again, so to speak. In the cases of countries like France, they were allies in the war, and England, they were allies in the war. We didn't occupy them. But they asked us to stay, and as NATO was formed and grew into a very important alliance, the conditions under which the countries participated in the U.S. participated in those countries, there were differences. Hiring practices, living conditions, status of forces agreement. So we were in France and England, to use two examples, as partners and allies, not as occupiers. Of course, that changed in 1955 in Germany, when Germany regained sovereignty and became a full-fledged partner in NATO, ultimately.
Sticking with the theme of World War II veterans, you have a funny story that took place when you and Mom were living in Turkey. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, this might be a bit of, it's kind of a funny story, but it does point up some of the friction that could exist between World War II veterans and the military of the day. In Izmir, Turkey, we had a principal who had been a paratrooper during World War II. Very masculine man, very physically capable and courageous man who had been decorated for valor in World War II. And we were working on an air base in Izmir. This was in the early 50s. And the principal would meet with the military officers at meetings, and he would stop at the officers' club occasionally to chat with some of the members of the club and get better acquainted. And he got a little tired of some of the young pilots, young Air Force officers, bragging about their feats. And he was asking if any of them had ever made parachute drill. Of course they had, but they hadn't done it in combat, and they had done it under much more controlled circumstances than our grizzled old high school principal had. So one evening he just got fed up with all this talk and said, "You know, I'm in a business suit, I'm dressed in civilian clothes, and I can go up in one of your planes right now and parachute out and bring my chute down right in the middle of the town park." And of course, they scoffed at that idea, and I don't know if they put down any money or not, but this guy then, in his probably mid-50s in his civilian suit, got one of those young officers, thank God his commander didn't know about it, to take him up in a little army aircraft, and he jumped out. It was about midnight in the middle of the Kultur Park in Izmir, and came right down to the astonishment not just of the young lieutenants and captains he'd been talking with, but to the Turkish community and the nightclub attendees at the Kultur Park casinos. And a good time was had by all. Nothing serious came of it, and there were some sharp reprimands and disciplinary memos submitted around, but overall it ended amicably.
Well, and that brings me to my next thing. So having schools on military installations would make them be safer, I would imagine. But I remember in the 70s, the U.S. military became the targets of like local terrorist groups, like the Baader-Meinhof gang or the IRA maybe. So what dangers did that put to schools? And were there ever any schools targeted by these local terrorist groups?
For the most part, that's true. The schools were far more secure over there on our military installations, and many of them are even now in American cities. And you're talking about a period of time when German terrorists, European terrorists, you mentioned the Baader-Meinhof gang, as opposed to Middle Eastern terrorists, were really taking on corporate Germany and corporate England and corporate America and military America. And there were rocket attacks on U.S. bases, and security was beefed up. Never heard of a specific threat by any of those groups to a school, but some of the more clever high school kids learned that if you called in a bomb threat, you could get school shut down for a day or two. And we had a rash of prank calls, all of which were always taken very seriously. We did hear of Baader-Meinhof plans to set off bombs in civilian communities, more German than U.S., but it certainly did lead to more security and more tightening of regulations on visiting schools and other installations, facilities and military installations.
So the last question I wanted to ask you was that I know that Princess Anne visited the U.S. school in Lakenheath back in the 90s, and that was in England. What special preparations had to be made for her visit? But then also, what other famous visitors can you think of that visited some of our schools?
Let me take the second part of your question first. Princess Anne, of course, cut the ribbon at the Lakenheath Elementary School in England. I don't remember the year, but we had visitors from various places who had celebrity status, both official, diplomatic, heads of state and so on, and, as well as movie stars and entertainers. Haile Selassie visited our school in Ethiopia. We had Walter Scheel, who was president of West Germany, visit our school in Bonn. Can't think of any others off the top of my head, but occasionally when celebrities would travel through on U.S. shows, singers, entertainers, they would drop by and talk with the kids and meet with classes. But you're asking about preparation. Preparation was usually very thorough, and one humorous example I can give you came when Princess Anne came to cut the ribbon at Lakenheath Elementary. Sometime ahead, probably a month ahead, British protocol and Her Majesty's protocol would meet with the Air Force protocol, eventually State Department protocol, on just how the visit would be conducted. So there were a series of meetings between representatives of the school system, of Lakenheath Air Base, of Her Majesty's security people, and the preparations were very thorough, just stagecrafted, really. So one of the final meetings before the princess would actually come, the head of her protocol restated for all to understand that the princess will arrive by helicopter, there will be an Air Force car pick her up, take her immediately to the American Officers Club for lunch. After lunch, the Air Force car will take her to the ribbon cutting ceremony, and after the ribbon cutting ceremony, she will stop by for a short reception and meet with parents of the school and the base commander and other dignitaries. And then a car would take her back to her helicopter, and away she'd go. All very thorough, all very carefully scripted, all very sensible. But one of the things that intrigued all of us listening to this was that Her Majesty's protocol officer kept saying that anything the princess touches that is at all disposable should be removed immediately and destroyed. The silverware she'd use at lunch, the plates she'd use at lunch, the cup she would drink of, the towels she would use in the ladies' room, even the seat of the toilet. And one of our lower ranking dignitaries said, I just have to ask, what disease does this lady have? And we have to remove everything she has touched. Much to the shock and indignation of Her Majesty's protocol chief, but who very patiently recovered his composure and said, it's to prevent souvenir hunters from getting hold of these things and exploiting them.
Wow, who knew? Well, we're out of time, and so I wanted to thank you, but this was just another look at what it's like to be a Eustace or Dodds teacher in the early days, and so I thank you, Dad, for joining us in our podcast, Schooling with Uncle Sam.
A pleasure.